And while we've studied the first two chapters of Judges so far, and we have found that Joshua is now gone, the people that are there during that particular time now have, most of them have died away. And the ones that are coming up have not known war. They've enjoyed the peace and the tranquility that their forefathers have fought for, and they're enjoying the bounty in this land of milk and honey. We're starting out in chapter 3 now, and we'll find that the book of Judges is full of the rise and the fall, and the successes and the disaster of the Israelites. There's one constant echo of people forsaking God and going for idols of worship. This is well that we can apply to our lives today, that we need to remember that other things can become idols for us and draw our attention away from putting God first in our lives, whether it be a job, personal increases in our finances, home, whatever. We can have those things and be so fixed on those things that it draws us away from what we need to be doing, and that is keeping God first in our lives. Remember Jesus' prayer in John 17:3. It says, "Now this is eternal life, that they know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent." And that was Jesus' prayer for the church. In Judges 2:10, says, "After that whole generation had died, another generation arose who did not know God or what he had done for them." In Judges 2nd chapter 22:23, "By their means I will test Israel." And this is God talking about leaving these remnants of these various peoples to dwell with Israel. And he says, "By their means I will test Israel to see if they will obey the will of the Lord as their forefathers did. And so the Lord left those nations alone and made no haste to drive them out or give them into Joshua's hand." And now we're starting into Joshua, the third chapter. And in this general, in this chapter, is just a general accounting of Israel's enemies and the troubles that they gave the Israelites. It's also an account of the exploits of the first three judges that we will encounter. Most of these accounts and these judges are of a local nature, involving just a few tribes and not the entire nation of Israel. Othniel was the first judge raised up, and he fought against Mesopotamia. Anybody have any idea where Mesopotamia is back in those days? Okay. That is what we would call Iraq today, but it's where Abraham originated, in Ur of Chaldees, also where Laban lived, and he made a hard taskmaster to Jacob. If you remember, Jacob worked for him for years. That was back up there in Mesopotamia. This king that from Mesopotamia was probably an area king and not the entire, wasn't the king of Mesopotamia as a whole. I think he was kind of a local king, and then and he came down and was causing the Israelites problems. Number two is Ehud. Remember him who rescued Israel from the Moabites. He worked on the eastern part of the Israelite kingdom. Number three, we have Shamgar, who killed 600 Philistines with an ox goad. Must have been a pretty healthy, burly, strong guy, kind of like somebody else we'll study about a little bit later. He worked on the west side, where Ehud worked on the east side. And I think they were pretty synonymous. I think they lived during the same period of time. And then if number four, we have Barak and Deborah, who fought against the kingdom, the Canaanite kingdom, led by a man named Sisera. Anybody available that wants to read?
I'll read.
Okay, I'm going to have my wife read verses 1 through 11 in chapter 3.
Okay.
Richard, would you like to read?
Yes.
Okay. Chapter 3, verse 12 through 31.
Okay.
And anybody else?
Sure.
Carol? Are you available, Carol?
Yeah.
Okay. Chapter 4, 1 through 7.
Okay.
Okay. Dean, would you do 4, 8 through 16?
Which Dean?
Dean Cruz.
Sure.
Is Dean...
What? Yeah, Dean Anderson, I think is probably here, but he has his camera.
Oh, does he? Okay. Are you up, Dean Anderson?
Yep, I'm here.
Could you read chapter 4, 17 through 23?
17 through 23?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, great. Well, we'll start out reading verses 1 through 11. Sharon, that's you.
Now these are the nations which the Lord left to test Israel by them, that is, all who had not experienced any of the wars of Canaan, only in order that the generations of the sons of Israel might be taught war, those who had not experienced it formerly. These nations are the five lords of the Philistines, and all of the Canaanites, and the Sidonians, and the Hivites, who lived in Mount Lebanon, from Mount Baal Hermon, as far as Lebo Hamath. They were for testing Israel to find out if they would obey the commandments of the Lord, which he had commanded their fathers through Moses. The sons of Israel lived among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and they took their daughters for themselves as wives and gave their daughters to their sons who served their gods. The sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and forgot the Lord their God, and served the Baals and the Asheroth. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, so that he sold them into the hands of Cushan-Rishathaim, I'm king of Mesopotamia, I'm sorry, and the sons of Israel served Cushan-Rishathaim 8 years. When the sons of Israel cried to the Lord raised up a deliverer for the sons of Israel to deliver them, Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he judged Israel. When he went out to war, the Lord gave Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, into his hand, so that he prevailed over Cushan-Rishathaim. Then the land had rest 40 years, and Othniel, the son of Kenaz, died.
Okay, so this gives us a description of the Canaanites who were left in the land, and it lists the five lords of the Philistines. These cities that they listed, three of those out of the five were destroyed by the Israelites in their initial attacks under Joshua. But apparently they were reoccupied at a later date by the Philistines. In 1 Samuel, the sixth chapter, if you'll remember, we studied that some time ago. We have the story of the capture of the Ark of the Covenant during the time of Eli. And these cities were mentioned as having tumors and rats because they had the Ark in their possession. And if you recall, Hophni and Phinehas, I believe their names were Eli's sons, were killed during that battle. The Ark was captured. And when Eli heard about it, that the Ark was captured by the Philistines, he fell off backwards off the rock he was sitting on, broke his neck, killed himself. But these Canaanites ended up with tumors and rats. They finally decided, and they knew very well what the problem was. And that was that they had something that belonged to the Lord, didn't belong to them. And they were paying a dear price for it. And so they got together, and they, after moving it around from city to city, they decided that they were going to get rid of the plagues. And so they put it on an ox cart and sent it back to Israel voluntarily so they could get rid of these plagues. But these Canaanites that were there, they caused the greatest amount of trouble, especially later in Judges. And they were never, these Philistines, they were never reduced in power, real power, until about the time of David. And as Sharon read, there were other nations left as well, such as the Hittites, Amorites, Hivites, Jebusites, and others. And God permitted them to remain for Israel's correction. And we find this mentioned in chapter 2, 22 and 23. God let these people remain for Israel's benefit. This was so that they could learn the art of war. These people that were there now they were born, raised into a land of milk and honey. Somebody else did the fighting for them, as I mentioned earlier. And they were not used to war. And so they didn't have a whole lot of protection when it came time to defend themselves. And of course, they're now going to have to defend themselves because God has been upset with them a little bit. And it's part of the punishment that he is meting out to them. But in chapter 3, verse 1 and 2, says that this generation had no experience in war. And we find that war is only learned by experience. We've seen this in our country in the recent century and a half. We've had to prepare. Once we went to war, after the war, we went right back in the same situation. So when the next war came along, we weren't very well prepared for that one. And so we had a lot of defeats along the way, lost a lot of battles. It took us a while to get back up to snuff and learn. It seems like someone once said we're doomed to repeat our mistakes of the past. And this is what has happened to the Israelites as they go along. In verse 6, it talks about the Israelites marrying into other nations. They joined in marriage. Verse 7, they served their gods and they forgot the Lord. And it wasn't long after Israel's settlement in Canaan that they began to corrupt the world, and their peace was disturbed. God was not going to put up with that. He kept his covenant, but they didn't keep theirs. In verse 11, or 8 to 11, we're finding that Othniel is of the tribe of Judah. He was probably older, and he was a witness to the Israelites' invasion and victories, and was surely a faithful servant. And he was probably heartbroken to see the demise of his faithful people, finding them so evil and forgetting of God's protection. So he judged Israel, found them wanting. He accused them of deserting God. He brought them to repentance. They were sorry. They wept. And after they did that, back in God's good graces, they went to war and they defeated the enemy. We have the same problem today. Our job is to really deal with our own shortcomings, our own sins. And when we do, then sins elsewhere will be a lot easier to deal with. So pull the beam out of our own eyes before we pull the splinter out of somebody else's. Okay, let's read 12 through 31. Richard, would you do that?
And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord strengthened Egon and the king of Moab against Israel, because they had done what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He gathered to himself the Amorites and the Amalekites and went and defeated Israel. And they took possession of the city of Palms, and the people of Israel served and the king of Moab 18 years. But then the people of Israel cried to the Lord. The Lord raised up for them a deliverer, Ehud, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, a left-handed man. The people of Israel sent tribute by him to Egon, the king of Moab. And Ehud made for himself a sword with two edges, a cubic in length, and he girded it on his right thigh under his clothes, and he presented the tribute to Egon, king of Moab. Now Egon was a very fat man, and when Ehud had finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people that carried the tribute, but he himself turned back to the sculptured stones near Gilgal and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. And he commanded silence. And all his attendants went out from his presence. Ehud came to him, and as he was sitting alone in his cool roof chamber, and Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. And he arose from his seat, and Ehud reached with his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh, and thrust it into his belly. And it hid also went into after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade, for he did not draw the sword out of his belly, and the dirt came in. Then he went into the festival and closed the door of the roof chamber upon him and locked them. Then he got, and when he had gone, the servants came, and when they saw that the doors of the roof chamber were locked, they thought he is only relieving himself in the closet of the cool chamber. And they waited till they were utterly at a loss. But when he stood, when he still did not open the doors of the roof chamber, they took a key and opened them. And they lay their Lord dead on the floor. He had escaped while they delayed and passed beyond the sculpture stones and escaped to Siret. When he arrived, he sounded the trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim, and the people of Israel went down with him from the hill country, having him at their head. And he said to them, "Follow after me, for the Lord has given your enemies to the Moabites into your hand." And they went down after him and seized the fords of the Jordan against the Moabs, and allowed not a man to pass over. And they killed at that time about 10,000 of the Moabites, all strong, able-bodied men. Not a man escaped. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest for 80 years. After him was Shengar, the son of Anath, who killed 600 of the Philistines with an ox goat, and he too delivered Israel.
Thank you, Reverend. Ehud was a Benjamite, and the Moabites were in Moabite, or the Moabites were in Benjamite territory. Jericho was part of Benjamin, and Moab had come across. Eglon had had his summer villa, his palace, built in Jericho, and was enjoying himself, and he was demanding tribute from Benjamin for 18 years. This was probably, again, an area war rather than involving the entire Israelite nation. It's kind of interesting because here we are, we're finding the Amalekites again. They've been a thorn in Israel's side for a long, long time. Eglon, it was kind of interesting because later on in Judges, we'll find that the tribe of Benjamin had an unusually large number of people who were left-handed. One Bible says that they were, their right hand was infirmed, right hand was weak. Others have said that they were ambidextrous and they could use both hands. But in this particular case, they had an unusually large number. I think it was like 700 that were counted in Benjamin that were left-handed men. So kind of interesting there. But after, Eglon was huge. I guess he had all access to all the dainties and the rich food and whatnot like that that he could handle. And he was quite large. And so when Eglon killed him, he left the knife in there and escaped and called for backup, and they defeated the Moabites after this 18 years of subjection. And so after Eglon's demise, Israel had peace for 80 years. We talked also a little bit about Shamgar, who used an ox goad to kill 600 Philistines. I looked up the what an ox goad was, and it was about 6 feet long, and several inches in diameter. And on one end, it had a metal prong to goad the ox. And on the other end, it had kind of a scoop to scoop the dirt and the mud out of the blade of the plows that were being formed. So quite a weapon. One commentator I talked to, or listened to and read said that he thought he was probably out in the field plowing when these Philistines showed up to give him troubles, and he took them on and killed the 600 of them. And so he must have been a pretty potent fellow. In the Song of Deborah, which we will just briefly go over, that's in all of chapter 5, which is coming up right away. Deborah sings about Shamgar and talks about the land was during his time was just inundated with outlaws and robbers and killers, and the main roads through Israel at that time were not traveled because of this. The villages were avoided, the unarmed villages, and the travelers stayed in armed fortified cities at the time in order to avoid conflict with these hoodlums. Let's do a carol. How about 4:1-7?
Yes. Then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. And the Lord said to them, sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. And the commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in... Yes. And the sons of Israel cried to the Lord, for he had 900 iron chariots, and he oppressed the sons of Israel severely for 20 years. Now Deborah, the prophetess, the wife of Lapidotha, was judging Israel at the time, and she used to sit underneath a palm tree, under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the sons of Israel came up to her for judgment. Now she sent and summoned Barak, the son of Abinadab, and Kadesh Naphtalah, and said to them, behold, the Lord, the God of Israel, has commanded, go and march to Mount Tabor, and take with you 10,000 men from the sons of Naphtali and from the sons of Zebulun, and I will draw out to you Cyrus, and the commander of the Jabin's army with his chariots and his many troops to the river Kishon, and I will give him into your hands.
Okay. Brother Dink, first, can you read 8 through 16?
Then Barak said to her, if you will go with me, then I'll go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go. She said, I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the honor shall not be yours on the journey that you're about to take, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hands of a woman. Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kadesh. Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali together to Kadesh. 10,000 men went up with him. Deborah also went with him. Now Heber the Kenite had separated himself from the Kenites, from the sons of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and had pitched his tent as far away as the oak in Zaananim, which is near Kadesh. Then they told Sisera that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor. Sisera called together all his chariots, 900 iron chariots, and all the people who were with him from Harosheth Haggoyim to the river Kishon. Deborah said to Barak, "Arise, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Behold, the Lord has gone out before you." So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. The Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army with the edge of a sword before Barak. Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Harosheth Haggoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the sword. Not even one was left.
Here we're finding this lady named Deborah. She was really a powerful woman politically. People went to her for judgment, and she was recognized certainly as a political leader, but also as a spiritual leader, a prophet, and that she certainly had avenue to God and was blessed by God. And so people came to her when she prophesied to Barak that she would Sisera would be given into his hands. He said, "Well, okay, but I'm not going to go by myself. I need to have somebody go with me that is knows the Lord and has got his blessing." And so because of that, she told Barak that, "Well, okay, I'll go with you." But joy of you winning this battle is not going to be yours. You're not going to get credit for that, but you're going to get, he's going to be done in by a woman. And so some of your thunder is going to be taken away from you." And then, of course, this is what has happened. Barak has defeated Jabin's army led by Sisera all the way back to his hometown. So killed a bunch of people there. And now he's after Sisera, who has jumped out of his chariot and took off running. Dean Anderson, would you read the rest of the chapter for us? 17.
Yeah. Okay. "However, Sisera had fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber, the Kenite. From there, for there was peace between Jabin, king of Hazar, and the house of Heber, the Kenite. And Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, 'Turn aside, my lord, turn aside to me, do not fear.' And when he had turned aside with her into the tent, she covered him with a blanket. Then he said to her, 'Please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty.' So she opened a jug of milk, gave him a drink, and covered him. And he said to her, 'Stand at the door of the tent, and if any man comes and inquires of you and says, Is there any man here? You shall say no.' Then Jael, Heber's wife, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand and went softly to him and drove the peg into his temple, and it went down into the ground, for he was fast asleep and weary. So he died. And then as Barak pursued Sisera, Jael came out to meet him and said to him, 'Come, I will show you the man whom you seek.' And when he had went into her tent, there lay Sisera dead with a peg in his temple. So on that day, God subdued Jabin, king of Canaan, into the presence of the children of Israel. And the hand of the children of Israel grew stronger and stronger against Jabin, king of Canaan, until they had destroyed Jabin, king of Canaan."
Okay, thank you, Dean. Jael was the wife of this Kenite named Heber, who was part of Moses' family, his in-laws. They were Midianites, but he separated himself and lives with the Israelites rather than back in the Midianite kingdom way south. This is his wife. He was not having any problems, I guess, with the Canaanites since he wasn't an Israelite. So he was at peace with them. So Sisera ended up in the tent, and he sought protection there because this was like a sacred place for privacy. You just didn't go into a lady's tent or a harem. You just weren't accepted in there unless you were specifically invited. And so he thought that was probably a safe place to hide. Several different Bibles call drinking milk. She gave him some milk. Others say she gave him some buttermilk. Others say sour milk, which is sort of the same thing as buttermilk. But anyway, it made him tired and he was sleepy. So she covered him up and he felt safe. But she took this tent peg, and boy, that must have been quite a peg. Go all the way through his temples and pegged him into the ground. Some of the different definitions of that says that she drove this tent peg through his temples, pegged him to the ground, and then she chopped off his head. Some translations don't say that, but I did read in a number of translations that included that in there. But anyway, so this is where they had rest after the Lord had Jabin, the king of the Canaanites, and his army destroyed. So now we go into chapter 5, and I think we'll just go ahead and let you read that at your leisure. It's just kind of a culmination of everything that has happened in the past. She touches on a number of things that we've already studied. And she is praising what happened in before her time as well as during the time. Talked about some of the judges and so forth and so forth. So just leave that to you to read at your leisure. It's the Song of Deborah, which takes up chapter 5. So next week, we'll start with chapter 6. And actually, this Gideon goes 6, 7, and 8, I think, for several, for quite a ways. But I think what we'll do is we'll just kind of take it easy. So we'll study chapter 6 next week and go over that a little bit and see what we can learn. Anybody have any comments?
Well, I'm impressed.
Hey, Ron.
Go ahead, Richard.
I was just wondering, I know sometimes way back then when somebody was killed sort of in that fashion where you said some, where they cut off their head, did anybody say anything about whether they put his head on a pole or his body on a pole like they did back then? Do you know, Ron?
No, it's not. It doesn't say that. They may have done that, you know, to display. You might be thinking about Saul and his son Jonathan later on, where they took his head, took their heads, and spiked them on their walls. But I don't know if that was a routine thing that they did back in those days, or if that was an exception. I don't know. Probably some of them did, they weren't afraid to draw some blood. That's for sure. you know, had to be a bloody way to do battle, to chop people up. But that was the thing back in those days. I don't know if that was a deterrent to anybody or not, but certainly would be to me. Did you have something to say, Dean?
Yeah.
Thank you. I was just, I'm very impressed at the status of women in Israel, because that's very different than the status of women in most other countries. And in most countries, women were viewed as nothing more than chattel property. But in Israel, it appears, I mean, Deborah was a judge,
yeah,
just like men were judges, and Jael fought valiantly. So I am impressed at the status of women, and I feel like God has valued women sometimes more than we have valued women.
You know, we find this from time to time, or time after time, in the Old Testament as well as the New, that women are held in very high regard, equal with men, different functions, of course, we understand that. But God honored women. You could see people like this, you know, mentioned from time to time in the Bible. With Ruth is one example. She's held in high regard. Esther, see that Esther was chosen. And so you go down through and you find people like this that were just set aside and were examples of God's choice. So certainly in today, you know, women have a very important role in worshiping the Lord. And I think they need to be honored just as well as anybody else. And you are right. Even today in some of the third world countries, women are not held in good regard. They have no rights to speak of. And, I'm surprised that we even have some people in our government, in our federal government, that propose that type of, that they uphold that kind of behavior. It's absolutely amazing to me that they're even in office. So anybody else got any comments?
Well, I'd like to kind of comment on the women thing. It certainly, Deborah held a position of honor and respect and authority. That's for certain. And Jael certainly did act very bravely to do what she did. That certainly there was bravery there. But it is interesting that Deborah told Barak that, okay, I'll go with you, but the honor is not going to be yours. It's going to be said that this is going to be at the hand of a woman, and a woman is going to get credit for this. Yeah. And then in chapter 9, we also see when Abimelech was killed, he begged for someone for his armor bearer to draw his sword and kill him so they can't say that a woman killed him, because a woman had just killed somebody with a millstone. So it's interesting that these everyday implements, these women implements, the women's tent peg, the woman's millstone, were fashioned to be used as weapons. So certainly shows resourcefulness on the part of the Israelites, but I guess it's interesting to see that some women, yes, indeed have positions of authority and of high regard, but at the same time, it was a put down to say that a woman would get the glory and the credit for this valiant effort, that he died at the hands of a woman. So there was still a hierarchy in the culture for certain.
Yeah. You know, that does bring up a thing, too, that we might think about in the next couple of weeks when we talk about Abimelech. was he was the first king in Israel. And who do we think was the first king in Israel?
Who was Saul?
Well, that's what we think, yeah. That's mm-hmm. what we but it tells us also that Abimelech was appointed king.
Mm-hmm.
So where does that come in? So think about that, and we'll talk about that in mm-hmm. a couple of weeks. If Saul was really the first king of Israel, and if he was, why, you know, what about Abimelech?
Was he the first God-anointed king, though?
Well, yeah, you're not supposed to say that yet.
Oh, sorry, got to the punchline. Huh?
That was supposed to be open for discussion.
Okay, sorry about that.
That's all right. We'll just skip it now.
No. I think it's an important point.
Well, we'll talk about it.